From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the president wants to impose steep tariffs on foreign steel and aluminum. What could that mean for the U.S. carmakers? Plus, a free state program helps high school dropouts over age 23 earn their diplomas, along with training for in-demand jobs.
This is now my fifth time attempting to get my high school diploma, the farthest I've ever gotten.
Blue ice piling up along the Straits of Mackinac.
These pieces of ice can be pushed up several feet or even meters on the shore.
Michigan wins the Big Ten tournament. Now all eyes on March Madness.
The question amongst Michigan State now is, who gets the draw at Detroit's Little Caesar Arena? They both want that. No matter what your seed is, playing in your backyard counts for a whole lot because those are your fans.
Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up later in this hour, we'll talk about how proposed tariffs on foreign steel and aluminum could affect the domestic auto industry and, in turn, Michigan's economy. But first, news that the state of Minnesota recently settled a lawsuit against 3M caught our eye. 3M is the company whose chemicals were used by Wolverine Worldwide to waterproof shoes, chemicals that have now contaminated drinking water in the Grand Rapids area. The $850 million settlement in Minnesota was over water contamination from similar chemicals that are all part of this broader group called per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS for short. Studies suggest that they're linked with various health problems, including cancers and miscarriages. And PFAS have been found in groundwater in 28 sites in 14 communities around Michigan. We got to wondering how the Minnesota lawsuit might inform Michigan's response to the PFAS contamination here. With us is Elizabeth Dunbar. She covered the lawsuit for Minnesota Public Radio and is with us now via Skype. Elizabeth, what led to this lawsuit?
Well, there was widespread contamination in the eastern suburbs of the Twin Cities area. This had been going on for a long time, and people had it in their private wells. The cities in that area had PFCs in their municipal wells, and the state of Minnesota decided that this was a natural resources damages lawsuit. They went after 3M to get as much money as they could to clean up the problem.
And the state was looking for, what, $5 billion in punitive damages, but they settled with 3M for $850 million. Why did the state settle for so much less?
Well, the Attorney General, Lori Swanson, said that a comparable lawsuit was won in West Virginia against DuPont. Same chemicals involved, and that one was settled last year for about $670 million. And she said that Minnesota is getting a good deal out of this. However, just in recent days, the Minnesota legislature scheduled a hearing to ask about the settlement and whether the state did get a good deal. There was about $100 million in legal fees that the state is having to pay to carry out this lawsuit. I mean, it was going on since 2010, so a lot of lawyers involved. That added up.
And what is the state's intention? What's it going to do with that money?
The money is used to kind of clean up the problem. So that could be drinking water supplies for the cities. It could mean new private wells for homeowners that have contaminated wells. It could mean hooking up private wells, hooking them up to a municipal system instead of a private system. It could look like a lot of different things. There's even opportunity in there for natural resources conservation projects. Because of PFC contamination in the Mississippi River, you can't catch fish and keep them there. And so the Department of Natural Resources says, well, maybe we should build some fishing piers on lakes that are not contaminated so people in that area can go somewhere to fish.
Now, I know we can't talk about these stories without tossing around a lot of acronyms, PFAS, PFCs, PFOA, PFOS, but they are all related. How significant are these chemicals to 3M's business?
They were very significant for many years. However, this lawsuit, you know, because it was settled, 3M is not saying that they did anything wrong. They're maintaining that they did not hold back any information about the health risks involved with these chemicals. And, you know, 3M still manufactures types of related chemicals today that they say are not as harmful as these other chemicals. And so this is something that is sort of a moving target for public health officials. Our Minnesota Pollution Control Agency head said, you know, what we're learning about these chemicals is changing all the time. The EPA recently established new health risk guidelines for these chemicals. And so there's still quite a bit that's unknown about them.
So 3M is basically saying we don't think there are public health risks related to these PFCs?
Correct.
Will an $850 million settlement, is that going to be enough to get 3M to make significant changes, maybe be more transparent about these chemical compounds, or is this to them more the cost of just doing business?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, $850 million is not a lot of money for a company 3M's size. They make a lot more in profits every year. So it's not seen as a big deterrent. But on the other hand, it is a significant amount of money. 3M said, you know, this goes along with the types of sustainability projects that we would fund anyway. And so we'll have to see how the money is spent eventually. There's going to be quite a process and probably a fight over how exactly it will be spent. So we'll be watching that closely.
For states, including Michigan, discovering PFAS contamination in groundwater here, what do you think the takeaways are from Minnesota's suit against 3M?
One of the challenges for states that are seeking money against these companies is that it is a situation where the science is somewhat limited in terms of linking this to actual harmful health effects. And so it's difficult. I think it would have been difficult for Minnesota to really make that case and for a jury to unanimously agree. However, there is consensus that there is a certain extent of risk involved with these chemicals, that they are in the environment, that they do bioaccumulate in fish and other species. And so I think a lot of states have been watching Minnesota's lawsuit and will be trying to see if they can do a similar action that might lead them to funds that will help clean it up.
Elizabeth Dunbar is with Minnesota Public Radio. Elizabeth, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
The already stunning photo ops at the Straits of Mackinac have gotten even better. Blue ice has formed at Mackinac, and oh, it's a bonanza for photographers. George Luskovich is a physical scientist emeritus at NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory. George, we're not talking about a smooth ice-covered surface here, are we?
No. Actually, what I think people are referring to now with this blue ice is, at least from the photos that I've seen taken in the Straits of Mackinac, is the ice that has broken up and been piled up on shore. At least those are the photos that I've seen.
When we talk about this, we're talking about like great big piles. How high are some of these piles?
These pieces of ice can be pushed up several feet or even meters on the shore.
And it's called blue ice. And why is that? How blue are we talking about?
People call it blue ice. It looks like, in the photographs, like it's a pale blue, like a powder blue, as opposed to maybe a darker blue that you would see from above lake ice that it forms on the water, the clear lake ice.
Mm.
But basically, it looks like the ice is more of a lighter blue. And that is basically because of three reasons or three processes. And one is that water absorbs other colors of the spectrum, or can absorb other colors of the spectrum. The second is the lack of bubbles or other inclusions in this ice. And the third would be the ice thickness and density itself. So, and they all, I think, are factors that cause this phenomenon, this what is called blue ice. And, of course, in the Straits of Mackinac, we know the water is fairly deep and fairly clear. So it's not like, you know, there's a lot of sediment in the water or even chlorophyll.
So are we talking about light reflecting in this ice as opposed to something in the water?
Yeah, as I mentioned, this selective absorption by water or ice selectively absorbs light in the yellow and the red part of the spectrum, so the longer wavelengths. And so the reflected light is then blue. Now, ice can also absorb the orange and green wavelengths, orange and green light, as light energy is absorbed by the ice, causing the water molecules in the ice to vibrate, which can lead to absorption of orange and green light. So, therefore, what the light that you have is a short wavelength blue light. Now, the second point is the lack of bubbles or other inclusions in the ice. This allows the light to penetrate further into the ice, and thus it absorbing more of the longer wavelengths, that is the yellow and red wavelengths and the other, you know, the blue and the orange wavelengths, leaving, again, the blue light to reflect back or pass through the ice. So if you have a lot of bubbles in the ice, then the light is reflected off of those air-ice interfaces or the ice-bubble interfaces, doesn't penetrate as deep, and comes back and looks either pale blue or white. It can occur probably anywhere on the Great Lakes. We have to start out with fairly clean, clear water, which is, you know, the situation, Lake Superior, certainly out in the lake itself. We're now talking, you know, about shoreline areas where there can be more sediment and so forth. But when this ice forms out in the lake and then breaks up and is pushed on shore, we need to start with fairly clear ice.
Is it common for us to see this blue ice piling up along the shores, or is this something pretty rare and that's why photographers are so excited?
It's not that rare. The ice, when it's broken, can be moved around by the wind. It depends on how thick it is because, again, I say thickness and density is one of the factors that causes blue ice. Now, with the ice that is piled up, thicker pieces, dense ice, few bubbles in it, and because of the absorption of the water, that is ice in, you know, solid state. And that's why we're seeing this ice that looks blue.
George Lushkovich is with NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory, where he's a physical scientist emeritus, explaining the beautiful blue ice along the Straits of Mackinac. George, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Still to come, are corporations with a conscience making a comeback?
There are now some small green shoots. They're still, you know, not up to summer height.
That comes up in 10 minutes right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan has won its second straight Big Ten title, and it did it by beating Purdue 75-66. Let's get into the weekend action from Madison Square Garden as we welcome Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. So, John, the Wolverines plowed through Iowa, Nebraska, Michigan State, and then Purdue to win this second Big Ten title. Let's go back to January. Did you expect this?
I don't know who did. Beilein's teams, John Beilein, the head coach at the Michigan basketball team, they always peak at the right time right around now, but usually it's a late process. So this team has been on an upward ramp much earlier than its usual teams. They could be as high as a second seed when it's all sorted out. Now, my guess is a third seed, some are saying a fourth seed, but this is one of his best teams he's ever put together.
Who were the heroes?
Incredibly, it's defense, which is not their specialty typically with Beilein's teams. And I have to say, for you non-sports fans out there, defense is a chore. It's a chore to coach. It's a chore to do. It's not all that exciting. You don't get a whole lot of credit for it. It's like filing your taxes, man. It's just something you got to do. And to inspire you guys to play better and better defense is how this team has done it. Mo Wagner, huge guy from Germany. He's one of their stars, of course. But Duncan Robinson, a guy's one of their worst defenders 2 months ago. They could not even have him out there in the last 5 minutes because he was too unreliable on defense. He is now one of their best defenders. So that, my friends, is coaching.
That's coaching, because you wonder what kind of alchemy turns that around in a matter of a few months.
Alchemy.
Yes.
That's nice drop there. It's a day-by-day process, I'm sure, but this team is playing right now as well as anybody in the nation. They've won 8 straight games against the nation's best. So this is a team you do not want to draw in the tournament.
And Michigan State was the number one seed going into that weekend, and they could not get it done Saturday afternoon against the Wolverines. What's going on?
Mo Wagner's one of a big reason. They had no answer for him. But having said that, look, State fans, there's no panic here. That team won the regular season Big Ten title, which is harder in many ways, in my opinion. And Izzo's team will be a top three or four seed, is my guess. So the question amongst Michigan State now is, who gets the draw at Detroit's Little Caesars Arena? They both want that. No matter what your seed is, playing in your backyard counts for a whole lot because those are your fans.
So, of course, next Sunday is Selection Sunday when everybody finds out whether they're invited to the big dance and everybody can start filling out their March Madness brackets. So how do you see this weekend's action affecting that seeding for Michigan and Michigan State?
Oh, Michigan launched itself. Went from, mid-seed, whatever, and that could be anywhere against anybody, to now you're one of the darlings of the dance. So they did themselves a lot of good this last weekend. Having said that, they barely got past a pretty weak Iowa team on Thursday in overtime. So this team can lose anybody. They can beat anybody. But again, you don't want to draw them. Michigan State, holding pattern, it won't hurt them very much. You're still the Big Ten champs. They slid down a bit, no doubt about it. But you got to the semifinals. And it is not a race your season. They've got four losses all year. Two of them are to Michigan. So this is a team everyone's going to take seriously in the tournament.
What are your thoughts about the fact that the Big Ten tournament was played at Madison Square Garden and earlier than usual?
Three thoughts, two of them negative.
Fire away.
One is the old man, get off my lawn. I'll tell you that why are you having this thing in New York? It's a Midwestern conference. It belongs in either Chicago or preferably Indianapolis because Indianapolis loves this tournament and they roll the red carpet. New York does not care. And to get Madison Square Garden, they'd go a week earlier than usual because it's booked. So now you're playing a week before everyone else does. So now you've got 11 to 12 days off before you play a tournament game again. So that's a hindrance. The flip side is I've got to eat some crow on this because they had great turnouts on Saturday and Sunday, partly because Michigan's in there with a huge New York contingency, of course. They got about 20,000 Michigan alums in New York, and they all seemed to be there in the stadium. So the place was rocking both days. Not on Thursday and Friday, but they pulled it out. So that said, no one wants to see it again. And the real question is going to be, is will the Big Ten teams be forgotten about between here and Selection Sunday when everyone else is playing? And two, who wants 2 weeks off before you play a game again? That might be a problem as well.
Rest is not a bad thing. However, momentum is good too.
We're going to find out which one's more important.
If you're Tom Izzo, what's job one over these next couple of weeks?
Stay focused. Block out everything else.
A lot of noise.
Block it all out. And they have this season, obviously. They're the Big Ten champs regular season. Block it all out. Deal with all that at the end of the season and get back in your game.
And if you're Beeline?
Stay sharp because you're playing your best basketball of the year and you got 11, 12 days off. So somewhere there you have to have some brutal practices to remind them what a game is like.
Any predictions for Final Four? Look at your face. Sorry, Chief.
So much can go wrong. A fool predicts these things, and I guess I'm that fool. Right now, I would say Michigan and Michigan. I bet one of the two will be in the Final Four.
All right.
Michigan, Michigan State.
We'll see there. Michigan's hockey team had a good weekend. Best of three sweep against Wisconsin in the Big Ten tournament quarterfinals. Your thoughts?
This team under Mel Pearson, first year coach at Michigan, but he had been an assistant coach for many years. Mm-hmm. They started out this year 9-10-2, which is below 500, which is nothing. Since 2018, basically, 12-3-1. They're one of the best teams in college hockey right now. They swept number one seed, number one ranked Notre Dame. They are now in the tournament, not expected. They're guaranteed to be in the tournament, and they're playing better and better. So hats off to Mel.
Now they are moving on to face Ohio State, and we know the Wolverines are, what, 0-4 against the Buckeyes this season?
Not your favorite matchup, right?
Yeah.
But right now, it's you're playing with house money. They're in. So whatever they do from now on is gravy.
Michigan Radio Sports Commentator, John Eubank. And thanks, John.
Thank you.
The goal of business is to make a profit, but big corporations are feeling new pressures to do more. Yes, go ahead, make money, but also do good. In an op-ed for The Conversation, University of Michigan economist Marina Wittman describes this new ethic that is spurred by investors, and she's joining us now. Always good to see you, Marina.
Hi, Cynthia. Really nice to see you again.
So you are a professor of business administration and public policy at U of M, but you once worked in the corporate world for General Motors when times were tough for domestic car makers. In the middle of economic hard times, what did you suggest GM's leadership do?
Well, I made a lot of suggestions to GM's leadership, most of which they didn't take because I said, essentially, this company is going to have to make huge changes or it's going to go down the skids. And yes, indeed, it did. I didn't anticipate how badly. I had charge of a group of staffs called the public affairs staffs, and I had no responsibilities for which plants got shut or when or whatever. I did at least convince the top management to lessen the pain a bit by, instead of just cutting off all United Way contributions by the company when they closed a plant, which is what they would usually have done because what they contributed depended on the number of employees, I persuaded them to sort of cut it down over a number of years because, of course, that was just one more terrible shock when they needed that money more than ever.
So be a good corporate citizen even if you're going through rough times.
That was the message. Mm-hmm. Although, as I say, these were little incremental things that could be done because those were really rough times.
But why was that important to do some kind of gesture?
Well, it may have attenuated a little bit the bitterness of the people who were dislocated, although I don't know how much. Or maybe it was just that the people who made these decisions, and these were very difficult times, could look themselves in the face a little better. I don't really know.
Well, in fact, let me ask you this. The idea of a company doing good, it's faded in and out of fashion. Mm-hmm. After World War II, big corporations were prodded into doing public good. Who was doing the prodding?
Well, they, to some extent, prodded themselves. They saw themselves as public statesmen. They set up something called the Committee for Economic Development, which got involved in economic issues of interest to the nation. And part of the reason that the so-called good corporation in those days was because, quite frankly, they didn't face a lot of competition, and therefore they could earn high profits. The rest of the world in the decades right after World War II was in no position to give U.S. competition a run for its money because Europe and Japan were recovering from World War II, and the so-called developing nations or emerging markets weren't yet sufficiently developed or emerged enough to pose competition. And domestically, American companies were very concentrated, which means less competition. So they could afford to make good profits, reward their stockholders, give their employees secure lifetime employment and good pensions, do things for their communities. They could satisfy all these so-called stakeholders.
And then, as you note in your piece for The Conversation, in the 1970s, economist Milton Friedman insisted a corporation's only obligation was to maximize profits for the shareholder, which contributed to that greed is good era, and spelled the end of the good company. In fact, was there not an obituary for the good company
in
Newsweek?
Yes, there was. Yes, there was a, still is, a very good reporter called Bob Samuelson, who wrote an RIP, Rest in Peace, the Good Corporation. And frankly, I don't think it was Milton Friedman's announcement, although that did have a good deal of impact in the academic world. It was more that nice, comfortable world that American companies had been operating in began to come apart. Yeah. Other countries became serious competitors. There were the two oil shocks. There was the disruptions in the international exchange rate system, motivated actually by the United States, because we had gotten ourselves into an impossible position. So it was really that companies couldn't count anymore on relatively little composition, high, steady profits, and so forth.
So business schools kind of, you know, that idea of your job is to maximize shareholder profits, business schools taught that ethic for a long time, but that has been changing.
It's been changing. Why? And if, you know, I have an appointment, or did, I'm a meritor now, but I did have an appointment in both the business school and the public policy school. And it was very interesting to watch Michigan's business school put more and more emphasis on the social aspects of business.
What drove that?
Well, two things. One, there was, again, more concentration in U.S. industry, and therefore more what economists called economic rents, what normal people would call high profits. So companies were once and again in a position to do good. And let's face it, I'm no Milton Friedman, but if a company doesn't make money, it soon will go out of business. So that's one requirement. The other thing is that both the media and the public in general were starting to put more and more emphasis on things like, one, the environment. Whoever heard of the environment in the 1960s? And also on a, what was a totally new idea when Nike was confronted by it in the 70s, was that companies should have some responsibility for the treatment of workers in other countries by their suppliers. The suppliers were not part of their company. They were independent companies. And the notion that an American firm should have responsibility for the behavior of a company that was independent was just mind-blowing. But eventually Nike came around, yeah, and now a lot of companies are taking their responsibility. And now the arguments are more about, well, are they monitoring it independently, mm-hmm, and are they monitoring it well enough?
But it's on the radar screen.
But it is definitely, yes, on the radar screen.
And as we see in your piece for The Conversation, big investors are the ones telling the corporate world, profit's not enough. If you want access to our billions, you better be a company that also does good. So why do these large investment firms,
well,
care?
Well, it's interesting because companies are caught in a real tension. As you say, the CEO of the biggest investment company in the world, BlackRock, sent out a letter to the chief executives of the 500 largest companies saying, if you want to keep our investment or get our investment, you'd better be thinking about not just making profits, but also doing socially useful things. On the other hand, many other great big investors who are saying to CEOs, if you want to keep your job, you'd better get those profits in the next quarter or the next year up, or keep them up, or you'll lose your job. And a lot of CEOs did lose their jobs when their shares tanked for one reason or another. So you've got the tension between these two opposing groups.
Two tunes they have to dance to.
Exactly, all at the same time. Exactly.
When we talk about things companies do that are socially aware or try to make the world a better place, what are some things that companies have done that fit that bill?
Well, one of the big ones, as I say, mm-hmm, was taking some responsibility, and there's an argument about how much, for the treatment of, mm-hmm, workers in their supplier companies in other countries. Another one, of course, is more and more companies are paying some attention to their environmental impact and are doing whatever they can to reduce that. Sometimes that works to their favor in the sense that it is also cost-reducing, but not always. And more companies are being pushed to take responsibility for their CO2 emissions, mm-hmm, and many of them have set goals on reducing those emissions, and in general are paying much more attention to their environmental footprint, so to speak.
Now, you argue in your piece that companies that are doing very well financially and will be benefiting from the windfall from the Trump tax cut should, right, look to bringing that good corporation back from the dead. How likely is that to happen?
Well, as I say, yeah, there are now some small green shoots. They're still, you know, not up to summer height.
They haven't blossomed yet.
They haven't blossomed yet, but they're definitely there. And companies are having to somehow resolve this tension that I just mentioned, mm-hmm, between some powerful investors who are focused only on short-term profitability and stock prices because they all want an exit strategy, and those like Mr. Fink of BlackRock. And also, of course, customers and employees are also putting pressure because the American public in general has become much more conscious of the widespread impact of companies on their stakeholders, of which their shareholders are one, but there are others, employees, communities, customers, and so forth. So they are confronting this tension. Now, to some extent, it's true that the companies that are getting the pressure for short-term profits are ones that are having significant problems. And what's astounding is the CEOs with well-known names that lost their jobs in the last year or two because some of these big, powerful investors were not satisfied.
It's an interesting story, which you can find at theconversation.com. Corporate America needs to get back to thinking about more than just profits. Marina Wittman, Professor Emerita of Business Administration and Public Policy at the University of Michigan. That's an interesting piece. We want to thank you so much for being with us to share it.
Thank you, Cynthia, for giving me that opportunity.
Coming up, a state program helping high school dropouts over age 23 earn their diplomas.
A person with a high school diploma will make about $230,000 more over their lifetime than someone with a GED.
It's free and it's changing lives.
This is now my fifth time attempting to get my high school diploma, the farthest I've ever gotten.
We'll be right back after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are more than 750,000 people in this state over age 23 who never graduated high school. Well, now there's a way for them to get that diploma, not a GED. Along with that, there are job training courses in construction trades and healthcare. So, a high school diploma and training for jobs that are going unfilled in Michigan, and all absolutely free. It's the Michigan 23 Plus Adult Diploma and Training Program. Greg Harp is Senior Vice President with Graduation Alliance, which administers this new Michigan 23 Plus program, and he's with us now. So, Greg, if something kept me from getting that diploma in high school, it sounds like a viable option, something for adult high school dropouts and employers looking to fill high-demand jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was really a good program that was passed by the legislature this year. It does sound a little good to be true, but the state has decided to fund it, make an investment in Michigan adults who, you know, for whatever reason, most often life challenges, they weren't able to complete their high school diploma.
So the program is being funded by the state?
It is, and it's going through the Michigan and Talent Investment Agency.
So exactly what is being offered in Michigan 23 Plus?
Yeah, so the program is focused on the high school diploma, so it's a true high school diploma. So I often tell people, you still have to earn it. It's not a shortcut. It's a true high school diploma that you need to earn, but it's designed for students who have struggled academically or for whatever reason didn't have their high school diploma. And then it's augmented by a number of things, employability skills, so aligned with the Department of Labor's 16 skills to pay the bills, a course that really teaches you how to be a good employee. As many people who have not had that experience don't understand what it really takes. It also then has industry credentials in healthcare if you want to be a home health aide, a caregiver, and it has the NCCER core construction trades that you can choose as well, and you can get those either individually or in conjunction with your high school diploma.
So it can be tailored to each person's needs and desires.
That's absolutely correct.
So people walk away not only with their high school diploma, which has greater punch than the GED, right?
Absolutely. If you look at the aggregate data, someone who has a GED versus a high school diploma, the person with a high school diploma will make about $230,000 more over their lifetime than someone with a GED.
You walk away with that diploma, and you can walk away with credentials and certification. As you say, that for jobs that are going begging, so Michigan employers can like what this is doing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we're looking for employers every day to connect with our graduates so that we are creating that pipeline for both employers and for those students.
So how does it work? Is this open to anyone in the state of Michigan?
So it's open to anyone in the state of Michigan who's over 23 and does not have a high school diploma or its equivalency, such as a GED or a HISET.
And courses are online?
The courses are online. Some of the construction courses you do have to take a hands-on component for, to use a hammer or a saw, those types of things. But the vast majority of the coursework is online.
And how much human support is there for people?
Yeah, so there's a lot of human support. So number one, there are teachers in every class that students can communicate with. There are academic coaches who will be your primary person that you're connecting with in terms of what to do, what course you need to go into, what to do this week, this month, you know, today, et cetera. There are 24/7 tutors, so you can call a tutoring hotline anytime at 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. There are also counselors that are available if you have social or emotional issues that are preventing you from doing your schoolwork. So there's a variety of support services around each student so that they can be successful.
Typically, how long? I know this whole program just launched in mid-December, so it's early on, this pilot program. Typically, how long might it take someone to get that diploma and to walk away with some kind of a job certification?
Yeah, it's a great question. It depends on the person, right? Because depending on how much credit they have, so I would say on average, a student is going to take probably between 3 and 6 months to get through. Some could take longer, some could take shorter, depending on the number of credits they have and which credential they're pursuing.
And how many students are enrolled right now?
So we're at about 250 students currently.
And how many can you take? Because I guess the question can be, do you have openings?
We do have openings. It's hard to say exactly how much you can take because everything's based on performance of, you know, the payments are based on the performance. So a credential costs a certain amount, a diploma costs a certain amount. So what we're doing is just monitoring how many of those outcomes are happening. But we could probably take about another 3 to 350 students, somewhere in that ballpark.
And now the pilot run of this program is until when?
It runs until the end of the fiscal year, which is September 1.
And then what do you think will happen, or what do you hope will happen?
Well, obviously we hope the legislature will decide to extend the program for another year, but that still remains to be seen. The budget process will start here in the next couple of months.
How will you measure success for Michigan 23+?
Yeah, so the whole program is based on outcomes. And so the outcomes that were passed in the legislation are high school diploma, obviously, employability skills course. So again, that's that Department of Labor 16 skills to pay the bills. Industry credentials like OSHA 10, which is safety course, the industry credential in healthcare, the industry credential in NCCER. Those are all successful outcomes, and the legislation pays for those outcomes for each one that's completed by each student.
And so this is for anyone 23 and older who have gotten through at least 10th grade.
That's correct.
Well, it certainly, I can see where this can really open doors for people and change the course of their lives. And you can get information and enroll very easily by going to Michigan23.com. Greg Harp is with Graduation Alliance, which has partnered with Michigan's Talent Investment Agency on the Michigan 23+ Adult Diploma and Training Program. Greg, thanks for talking to us about it.
Cynthia, thank you for your time.
One of the students in Michigan 23+ is Michelle Hudak of Clarkston. Hey, Michelle.
Hi.
You and your husband, Dale, are both enrolled in Michigan 23+?
Yes, we are.
So what did you think when you first heard about this program?
I've actually been trying to find a program that met all of the requirements I was looking for the past year. And my grandma fell upon it on MLive.com and printed out all the paperwork, told me about it, and within a couple of days, I went online. Next thing you know, the next day after I went online and registered, we were both already starting our classes free of charge.
Oh, that's important. So, yes, what are you paying for these classes?
Absolutely nothing.
So what was getting you thinking? You say you were for about the last year thinking that you wanted to find some kind of training program and you wanted to get your diploma, right?
Yes.
What was causing that?
Well, we are now actually about to have our fifth kid together. And we kind of told our boys, we wanted to be able to graduate at least by the time that they graduated high school. They're 10 and 12. Mm-hmm. Well, I should say 9, 10, 11, and 12. And then I'm about to have another one. So we kind of made a promise that we were going to become high school graduates, so everybody in the house would be one.
So when did you actually start the classes?
We started February 6th.
All right. So what are you taking?
I'm just doing my regular high school diploma right now, but I also did CareCorps, which is a caregiving program as well. It's a 2-week caregiving program that's supposed to help you get job certifications. And that was free of charge as well through the program.
And being able to do this online, you can make it work with your life. You've got to be very busy with 4 little ones and a fifth on the way.
Oh, yeah. Definitely keeping myself busy. But the kids understand what I'm doing and they kind of give us our space.
And what is he studying? What's Dale taking? Does he want to do job training as well?
He is actually going to finish his high school diploma, and then he's going to try to figure out what kind of skills he wants to do. He was thinking about doing a couple of them.
So now, do you have a graduation date? Do you know when you'll be done?
The website actually says March of 2018.
What kind of support are you getting? I know you're doing the classes online. Is the help there that you need to be able to kind of succeed in these classes?
Oh, yeah. Everything that you need is right there. They got the teachers. You have your own coach on top of your teachers. And then you have online tutoring. Then you have technical support. You got numerous people, beyond numerous people that you can contact.
What do you like most about Michigan 23 Plus?
The fact that it's completely free. This is now my 5th time attempting to get my high school diploma, the farthest I've ever gotten.
What does that feel like?
Amazing. More amazing than anything.
What would having those high school diplomas in hand and that extra career training mean to both you and to your husband, Dale?
Honestly, that would mean the world to us because we can show our kids if we can do it, then anybody can.
This is great. Well, Michelle, you and Dale, we wish you a lot of success as you work your way through the Michigan 23 Plus program. And we want to remind everybody there are still many openings for people over age 23 who have completed 10th grade but didn't get their high school diploma and also who are looking for training and certification and some high demand jobs. Details are at Michigan23.com. Michelle Hudak, good luck.
Thank you so much.
President Trump is digging in on his promised tariffs on foreign aluminum and steel. 10% on imported aluminum, 25% on imported steel. That announcement sent the stock market tumbling and got our European and Canadian allies talking about possible trade wars, retaliatory tariffs on American-made products. And the pushback from the president's own party is growing. House Speaker Ryan has split with the president. The House Speaker opposes the tariffs, and congressional Republicans are figuring out how to block them. What could all of this mean for the U.S. auto industry? Kristen Jicek is here with us now, director of the Industry, Labor, and Economics Group at the Center for Automotive Research. Kristen, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the president says globalization is wiping out our middle class and getting tough on foreign steel and aluminum as a way to even the playing field for the U.S. steel and aluminum industries. Is he right on that?
There is a problem with aluminum and steel production and output in the global economy, largely because China has grown from being a very insignificant producer to supporting a huge growth in steel and aluminum production capacity. Now, the U.S. auto industry does not use a lot of Chinese steel, but the effect of that is that it pressures price downward. And so the prices have been low. And if we have a trade protection around the U.S. industry, then prices will rise because we'll be pushed more toward domestic sources. And even those domestic sources, those mills that produce aluminum and steel in the United States, may have imported inputs to their process that will also be affected by this.
So it's not as simple as what I think we're hearing from the president telling, for example, the car makers will go back to buying mostly American-made steel.
They already do. Canada is our largest steel and aluminum importer. The president's action is under something called 232, which is a provision of trade law that allows you to say, we're trading a really important good that's important for our military with somebody who might be potentially hostile or that we might go to war with. So we will have this supply coming from someone that might not want to supply us. Other than a movie that John Candy made many years ago, I don't think we're having a war with Canada.
Certainly, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has taken great umbrage at this implication that national security is in.
Well, it's a very strange use of national security and claiming economic security is national security, which, you know, that's probably true. But for this provision of this trade law, it's a very unusual interpretation. While we don't buy a lot of Chinese steel or aluminum, that having that capacity and that overcapacity in the global market pressures prices downward. Now, if the U.S. does enact these trade barriers, all of that steel and aluminum that might have been coming to the U.S. from other trading partners will be diverted to other markets. And if the U.S. 232 case holds, what's to stop them from saying, national security, we're going to put up a trade barrier to that imported steel and aluminum as well. And it's a very strange situation to be in.
And certainly we hear and we can read presidential tweets punching back at Canada and at Europe, warning, all right, EU, if you retaliate with tariffs on U.S. products like jeans and Kentucky bourbon, I'm going to slap a tariff on European cars. What does all of that mean for U.S. car makers?
Well, you know, the United States auto industry, which, you know, is made up of German and Japanese and Korean and U.S. producers, this is a very globally integrated industry. And we buy a lot of parts and components here in the U.S. from all of our trading partners, and they buy parts and components from us. So, you know, what does it mean for the tariff on EU vehicles? We don't yet know what he's going to produce or what the tariff might be. On the campaign trail, he said 35%. A lot of the vehicles that come from, say, Germany, for example, are luxury vehicles. But even at that price point, no one's going to absorb a 35% price increase on a 7 Series.
No, they're not. And as he accuses the Europeans of making it impossible for our cars to sell it there, if we have a trade war, that isn't going to help, is it?
It's going to make it more difficult. And it's true. Germany sends about 500,000 vehicles to the U.S. market annually. In 2017, that was where we were. And we send about 61,000 vehicles there. Right now, say with China, we send about 250,000 vehicles to China, and they send us 25,000 vehicles under the brand names of Buick and Volvo. So we're very integrated, and there's also a thing called comparative advantage. So when you get into trade, or even in multilateral trade especially, but when you get into trade, there are some things that countries are better at than others, or maybe they have the right climate. One of my favorite things in the world is tequila, and it's grown and made in Mexico and very few other places. So if you want to have that in your country, you need to trade for it. And what are you good at making? What do you do well and very efficiently? And that's how you get involved in trading agreements with the rest of the world. What is your comparative advantage? And what does the other country or the rest of the world have that you need?
Does making foreign product more costly bring more business to U.S. companies?
Not necessarily. It does raise prices on U.S. consumers. And the U.S. consumers will see this first. The retaliation often does not come in the same form that the trade action took place. So we're putting a tariff on steel and aluminum, and we're getting back responses on bourbon and orange juice and motorcycles. You may recall that there's something called the chicken tax in the auto industry. There was a dispute in 1963 over frozen chicken exports to Europe. And in some complicated, I wasn't around, I don't know, some complicated mechanism, we ended up with a 25% tariff on imported pickup trucks to the United States. And there were a number of other provisions of that trade measure at the time. The only one that survives is this 25% tariff on pickup trucks, which is called the chicken tax because it was a fight about frozen chicken exports from the United States. So, you know, the thing is, the U.S. is a big exporter of agricultural goods. The agricultural sector is likely to be harmed by this action to protect the U.S. steel and aluminum industries. There is a case that there's global overcapacity and that prices are artificially low. There is a case that some of this matters to national security and to our military. The issue that many people have with this action is that it's entirely broad. It does not say this particular type of steel, form of steel, grade of aluminum, this particular trading partner. It's all steel and aluminum products, all trading partners. And that's very unusual.
What do you think is the best plan of action for U.S. car makers in response to the possibility of these tariffs coming down?
Well, the United States auto industry does not like uncertainty. You can see that in how they plan and produce vehicles. So a vehicle may run 5 or 6 years in production. Before they start production of that vehicle, they lock in their steel or aluminum suppliers on long-term contracts. There are some provisions that if the price varies, that you can come back and renegotiate, but there's nothing in there usually about putting on a 25% tariff or a 10% tariff. Right now, we're at a point in the auto industry where we just tipped over. We had a peak year in 2016. 2017 was down about 2% in terms of U.S. auto sales. The pricing is starting to soften a little bit, so U.S. auto prices are not keeping up with inflation, so there's not as much pricing power. The price of a used vehicle is at a 10-year low. That's the best substitute for a new vehicle is a used vehicle, and there's plenty of used vehicles in supply. That's why the prices are depressed. This could impact sales and production in the United States. What we should do is work with our trading partners and work to contain China. China's overcapacity is what is pressuring prices downward. It's what's making it difficult for any domestic steel and aluminum producers in the U.S., in Canada, in Mexico, or Germany to be able to compete in the world market. So what we really should do is take on the real problem, which is Chinese overcapacity.
Kristin Jicek, Director of the Industry, Labor, and Economics Group at the Center for Automotive Research. Thanks so much, Kristin.
You're welcome, Cindy.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.